From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KCUR in Kansas City. It's Here and Now. President Trump is declaring a public health emergency today to fight an opioid epidemic that is raging across the country. As many as 150 Americans die of overdoses every day, many of those from heroin and other opioids. The president's announcement frees up some federal money and broadens the reach of medical services in rural areas. Joining us now is Missouri's Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill. Senator McCaskill, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And what do you think of the Trump administration's response to the opioid crisis?
Well, I think declaring an emergency is important, but it is not going to make much difference if we don't actually put resources towards this public health crisis. In fact, it was in Kansas City where I had one of my most memorable discussions with emergency room doctors about the opioid crisis. And this doctor explained to me that we were the only country in the world that were prescribing opioids at the rate that America is consuming them. I just hope that the administration realizes there is not an easy fix to this. It is complex, and there's many different parts to it.
Why do you think it has taken the administration and Washington in general so long to respond to it? Then it's such a crisis at this point.
I think that we have always given mental health issues a short shrift. You know, we have a Zika virus and everyone is on full-blown panic attack, but people start dying all over the country from heroin overdose, and we were way too slow to recognize the epic proportions that this had reached, because the genesis of this problem, so much of it, is rooted in our medical system, our healthcare system, that we're not very good at asking the tough questions, for example, of the sales and marketing techniques of pharmaceutical companies. We were not really being honest about the need for treatment beds, and that the vast majority of people who are addicted to opioids no longer have money, and they rely on Medicaid beds. And so it's kind of discouraging to me that the president, who's declaring it an emergency, also has been very supportive of three different health care replacement plans that would have cut Medicaid funding.
One of your colleagues in the Senate made some big news this week. Jeff Flake says he's not going to run for reelection. He's a Republican and a major critic of President Trump's. What do you think about that? And do you expect other senators to come forward and say similar things, Republicans?
It's very hard to tell whether other Republicans will speak out in the way that Jeff and Bob Corker have, and to some extent other colleagues of mine like John McCain. I believe they are captured at this point by the reality that the base of the Republican Party is still, by and large, very dedicated to this president and are willing to overlook some of the things he has said and done. And they're willing just to kind of look the other way and believe that he is going to make a major change in Washington. So I don't really know that there'll be other Republicans that will speak out. But I certainly admire Jeff Flake's courage.
Do you think that his departure from the Senate, though, and Bob Corker's, is a win for President Trump or a loss for President Trump? Because, of course, he won't have to deal with them after 2018, but at the same time, they may be more against what he wants to get done between now and then.
Well, knowing both of those men, I don't think they would ever vote against President Trump just because they are frustrated with him and have shown that they don't respect the way he's handling his job. I think they'll vote what they think is the right way to vote. And so a lot of that will depend on whether or not they agree with the policy. There's a lot of uncertainty right now about whether or not this Congress, with the Republican majorities and a Republican in the White House, can actually do the things they want to do with just Republican votes. I'm somebody who believes very much that the true success of this administration would be reflected in their ability to get bipartisan solutions to the thorniest problems we face, whether it's simplification of the tax code or health care.
What do you think 2018 holds for you? Are you facing, do you think, a more difficult reelection battle than you did against Todd Akin?
I don't know. I always feel like an underdog in Missouri. It's a divided state. you know, I am proud to be a moderate. That's a little bit out of fashion right now. Hmm. Somebody who wants to promote compromise and wants to promote us finding the sweet spot in the middle. So I guess we'll see whether or not there is still a place for a moderate to hold the United States Senate seat in Missouri.
Well, I saw an ad this morning on TV in Kansas City that said something like, tell Claire McCaskill to vote for tax reform. Is it possible that you, as a moderate, will vote for tax reform with the Republicans?
I would be happy to vote for some of the principles that the president and the Republicans have advocated in tax reform. But the way they have drafted the bill so far, it won't work for middle-class families. For example, the way it's drafted so far, what we know so far, a family of four in Missouri that makes $50,000 a year would actually pay $887 more, while millionaires that have pass-through entities, the limited liability corporations and sub-S corporations, they're going to get the benefit of a dramatic tax rate cut for them. I can't go for that. If the president is sincere, and if the Republicans are sincere, that this is about a competitive global corporate rate and helping middle-class families, I'm down. But if this is about helping the millionaires and billionaires, they're doing fine. They're doing fine. My family is doing fine. So it all depends on what they actually end up proposing, which we still don't know. And I'm worried the reason we don't know is they're going to try to ram it through with just Republican votes.
That's Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad you guys visited Kansas City. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
Well, Brexit talks are not going well. The UK is threatening to walk away from the EU without a new trade deal. And the EU wants the UK to pay a huge divorce bill as it leaves. So let's get an update from NPR's Frank Langfitt. He's in Cornwall in the far west of England. And Frank, I have to say, there hasn't been much progress in these negotiations. So what's the problem?
Well, it's complicated, but the big issue, which you were alluding to earlier, is money at the moment. The UK is scheduled to leave in 2019, leave the EU. The EU wants Britain to pay off all of the commitments that it made to the EU budget through 2020. It doesn't want to talk about a new trade deal for the UK until there's an agreement on a figure. Now, neither side's publicly said exactly what their number is. The reports are that the UK is offering around $23 billion US. The EU wants apparently a lot more, maybe as much as $70 billion. Some members of the ruling Conservative Party here in the UK are threatening not to pay the bill, walk away, and give up a future trade deal with the EU.
Okay, well, if they did that, though, I mean, the EU market represents more than half a billion people. I mean, wouldn't the economic impact be enormous on the UK?
Well, most economists do think that in the end, a lot of businesses here and consumers would pay. What would happen is trade with the EU would then fall to World Trade Organization rules. And so basically, the UK would give up all of these great trade advantages that they've enjoyed for decades. Economists figured that there'd be significant price increases for imports in fruits, vegetables, pork and beef. And if you talk to the London School of Economics, they're saying over a decade, trade with the EU, which is right now, of course, the largest trading partner, would fall by about 40%. So generally, this would be seen as a big self-inflicted wound.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating, Frank, because a lot of people voted for Brexit because they didn't like the regulation from the European Union. But those same businesses now stand to have this enormous loss. I mean, and the business community in Great Britain, are they concerned about this?
A lot of them are very concerned. Although it's interesting, you know, I'm in Cornwall, as we were just talking about. I was just actually in a mine, a tin mine they're trying to reopen. And the fellow there was saying, of course, since the pound has dropped, the value of the pound, he could actually sell his tin for a lot more money to China. So some exporters will benefit. On the other hand, though, what you're hearing from a lot of companies is they're very, very worried because of this close relationship with the EU. Toyota has recently saying they want clarity on these negotiations. Companies making cars here in Britain, the vast majority of what they import is to the EU. They're concerned about tariffs. There's a lot of worry about that.
Well, now, what about the situation with Prime Minister Theresa May? I mean, she has been the subject of enormous criticism, even from the Conservative Party there in the UK, over Brexit. So what's her strategy here? And let me just cut to the chase. is she going to survive as prime minister?
Well, and that's sort of the constant question here. You know, she remains head of the Conservative Party and thus prime minister because she's seen as the least worst option at the moment. The Tory party cannot agree on who would replace her. They're also really worried that if there was a leadership battle, they'd trigger yet another election. People here are exhausted by elections. And the fear is that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party would get in, and Jeremy Corbyn's an avowed socialist. That would be a disaster for the Conservatives. A lot of people see this as, to some degree, a negotiating tactic. If they refused to pay into the budget and they walked away from a free trade deal, it would blow a hole in the EU budget. But also, it's a very interesting thing. Theresa May is using her political weakness to some degree as as leverage, which is astonishing, but that's where we are politically here in the United Kingdom. She's basically been going to Brussels and saying, you know, give me a deal that I can sell to my voters. And so there's an interest in the EU not doing more damage to her, because they don't want to lose her. That would just create even more disarray and more delay on actually working this whole thing out.
The whole thing's astonishing. NPR's Frank Langfitt speaking to us from Cornwall in the United Kingdom. Frank, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Meg.
We're broadcasting from KCUR in Kansas City today as President Trump and Republicans in Washington continue their push for tax cuts at the federal level. We've been reporting on what happened in Kansas. The state passed massive tax cuts in 2012 that caused such a budget crisis that Republicans in the legislature turned against the Republican governor and undid many of the tax cuts. One of the Republican lawmakers who led that fight was Melissa Rooker, who represents suburban Kansas City in the Kansas House of Representatives. Rooker has been an advocate for public schools, which were hit particularly hard after the tax cuts, so we met in a new high school in Johnson County. What went wrong with those tax cuts?
Well, when they were first proposed, the governor's original plan in 2012 included a menu of things that would pay for the income tax cuts themselves. But they were all, you know, fairly unpalatable items, abolishing itemized deductions and stripping away different elements of taxpayer exemptions that the lawmakers rebelled against in the Senate. They were all stripped out. The bill passed without those pay-fors, but with many more tax cuts embedded in the bill. And so it became more expensive and there was less work done to pay for them. It passed the Senate originally on the promise from the governor that those deficiencies would be fixed in conference committee. And instead of going through the normal process, procedures were used to push it through.
Were there also promises that it would essentially pay for itself?
Absolutely.
Because the economy would grow so much that it wouldn't be a problem?
The famous quote, the governor himself went on a press tour to promote the plan after it passed, and he called it a shot of adrenaline to the heart of the Kansas economy. It was Art Laffer, it was Stephen Moore, it was all of the same players that we're seeing today pushing the same concept that tax cuts will pay for themselves. So we had dynamic models that were shown that showed explosive growth and you know, it would be great for the state. The static traditional budget models told us what would happen. People chose not to believe them. They wanted to believe the pie in the sky version.
When did you realize that the tax cuts were not working?
Well, I knew at the time. I was not elected to, and I didn't have a vote on them in 2012, but I was watching very carefully as a parent advocate for K-12 schools. The facts were there, but the rhetoric was used, the conservative ideology of tax cuts. Well, that's not even conservative. That's not fair to call that conservative. I think it's somewhat radical, the ideology used to pass these cuts.
And what were the politics like for you as a Republican saying this is the wrong approach?
You know, the truly conservative arguments against these tax cuts is it forced us to borrow hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, through our ability to issue state bonds. We delayed payments. We shirked obligations. None of that is truly conservative fiscal management. So, you know, no one wants bloated government. I don't want people on the state's payroll that aren't contributing productively, but there's a certain level of staffing that our agencies need. There's expertise they ought to have, and you know, inflation affects state government like it does the mm-hmm. private sector. So as costs were increasing, we had nothing to work with. Our bond rating was reduced 3 times. So as a Republican, talking about responsible fiscal management, I had no problem suggesting that these tax cuts were a problem and we needed to change course.
And you did change course.
We did.
How did that finally happen?
It took a lot. It took a couple of election cycles to make it happen. The legislature began to change in 2014. The advocacy groups around the state began to pull together because I think those constituencies began to see that there was a pretty similar list of lawmakers voting against the interests of those groups in terms of not being willing to right the fiscal house of the state. And the message, the education of the voters, the message that was pushed began to be a lot more cohesive. And bottom line, the cuts to state government began to affect people personally.
More so in schools than any other area or across the board?
I think across the board. We have waiting lists for people who have a family member that needs, a disabled family member. There is a waiting list. I think it runs to 7 or 8 years long to wait for those services. The loss of accreditation to our state mental hospital. Those issues don't touch a particular political sector. That transcends. So you start having families affected because of lack of services. Public safety. We had counties in the state with not a single highway patrol officer on the beat. We had trouble staffing. Riots in our prisons. The foster care system in our state, it's an unbelievable disaster right now. We have had some high-profile cases, children's lives lost, children themselves lost from the system. We don't have the people available to assign to those cases to try and find them and get them back because we're so short-staffed.
Do you think taxes are going to have to go up again in Kansas?
Well, we just had a Supreme Court ruling. The state lost the school finance case, and this, I think, was the last layer of appeal.
The court said that the state is not adequately funding
the
schools.
We're not adequately funding. We missed the mark by... they didn't name the number, but they pointed to the studies that direct where spending should be, and we are basically at minimum $600 million short of where we should be funding our schools. So that will be the main feature of the upcoming session is how we deal with that, because there's no appealing this.
When we spoke with the lieutenant governor, who's going to become the governor, he was very noncommittal about what was going to need to be done, whether taxes would have to go up or there would have to be cuts.
I would challenge anyone who's proposing that we solve this by cutting the budget to point to where there is still room to cut our state budget. We have tried, and we have had, I would remind people, because the knock on using Kansas as an example is that, well, they never made the spending cuts they should have. We actually have cut the budget 9 times. What's left to cut will cause demonstrable harm.
As you know, we're having this debate now in Washington because President Trump and the Republicans in Congress would like to pass what President Trump calls massive tax cuts, which includes cutting the pass-through business tax, which is something that was done in Kansas. What would your advice be right now to lawmakers in Washington about what to do on tax cuts?
I would say the lessons we drew here in Kansas were that you need to have metrics in place to ensure that if you are cutting taxes in order to create new jobs, that there are some requirements that the recipients of those tax cuts have to meet in order to receive them. There has to be demonstrable hiring in order to receive the cut would be my number one recommendation. I would be very careful that you don't cut so deeply that there are required budget cuts that do harm. I think we have to be very careful about cavalierly throwing out budget cuts as something that can be done without hurting real people in their everyday lives.
There are going to be some listeners who hear you, and they'll be surprised to hear that you're a Republican and not a Democrat, given what you're talking about.
Well, again, I would point to the fact that I do believe in managing our money very responsibly. Borrowing, delaying payments, yeah, all of that is really reckless fiscal management. I am a Republican because I do think that there is an appropriate role for government in our lives. It's a civic philosophy that government has a proper role. It needs to be contained and not intrude too much on our personal lives. I share those beliefs, but there is a proper role for a functioning government, and that is what I stand for, which I think is a very Republican idea.
How do people treat you now in Kansas, given your role in undoing what the governor did?
My own constituents, there's a percentage that probably aren't happy, but I go out and get treated to strangers coming up to thank me. They recognize me and appreciate the work. My actual constituents knew what I wanted to do, voted me into office, and appreciate the fact that I did what I said. Americans for Prosperity, on the other hand, is trying to gin up opposition. So they've started a year ahead of our actual campaign season. They're dropping negative postcards in districts of all of us who voted to override the governor on the tax plan. So they're trying to create that pushback, but it doesn't exist naturally because people are pretty pragmatic in Kansas.
That's Melissa Rucker, who represents the 25th District of Kansas in the state's House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Americans for Prosperity, which she just mentioned there, is the political organization run by the Koch brothers, who are based in Wichita, Kansas. You can find more of our reporting on the Kansas tax cuts at hereandnow.org. And by the way, today in Washington, Congress approved a joint budget resolution that's a critical step to pave the way for tax cuts. It allows Republicans to write a tax bill that only needs 51 votes to pass the Senate.
The Sinclair Broadcast Group, a conservative media juggernaut, is poised to own TV stations that would reach 72% of U.S. households. It's already the largest television owner-operator in the country, but now Sinclair looks to acquire the Chicago-based Tribune Media. And while the Federal Communications Commission has not yet signed off on the merger, it has paved the way for it with a series of new rules. Joining us now with more is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi there, David.
Hey, Meghna.
So first of all, give us a little background here on Sinclair. Who owns the broadcast group and how big are they right now?
Oh, they are big. They're owned by the Smith brothers just outside Baltimore. I used to cover them as the media reporter for the Baltimore Sun many years ago. And they've been growing in influence in a couple of ways, one of which is through sort of the embracing an explicitly conservative outlook in their commentators and in taking adopting that for many of their story selections. And by consolidating a lot of those selections around their stations, they now own or control different ways to count it, but about 170 stations nationally. And they are poised, if the FCC approves, to take over Tribune Media's stations, which would add another 42 to that, taking it to over 200 stations, which would reach, as you said, I think about 72% of the country.
So
it's by far the largest amount of any company in the country.
Enormous then. Okay. Of course, the merger hasn't yet been completely approved, as we talked about, but the FCC has made certain rules changes that could allow for Sinclair to increase its dominance. What are those changes?
Right. Some have been made. Some appear to be on the way. If you listen to what Ajit Pai has said in recent days, the chairman of the FCC, it's a great bouillabaisse of changes. In fact, there was a lift on the amount of stations a company could own through a shift in sort of technical definition of what's allowed and what isn't kosher. That was lifted, which is, led to Sinclair's pursuit of Tribune Media's stations. There's been an easement on the idea, it appears, or will be, of whether or not a station can own more than one station in a given town. Pai has said that he'd be interested in easing that. For example, if it's in the public interest for a powerful station's owner to pick up a more ailing station, even in a smaller market, they might say they'd be tempted to go for that. There's been a lift of what's called cross-ownership, which is that they're going to release essentially decades-old prohibitions on the same company owning a newspaper and major television station in the same town, the sort of thing that's kept Rupert Murdoch from owning the Los Angeles Times at the same time he has two television stations in Los Angeles. And there's the list, the lift of the prohibition of the centralization of news production. There's been a rule that says that people have to produce news locally as a desire to emphasize local media production as well as consumption, and this appears to be eased or lifted as well.
Meaning that the news could be produced anywhere and then piped to stations across the country.
That's right.
So this sounds like a wholesale change for some of the basic rules that the FCC has applied nationally to ensure diversity in ownership and content in television media or broadcast media across the country.
It is. And the interesting thing to think about it in light of Sinclair is the fact that it is such an explicitly conservative outlook. It takes a not only an ideological line, but at times a partisan line. It's been a very pro-Trump line in certain elements of commentary, even as some of its journalists do very good work, that you could see that consolidated in cities and states and regions across the country, taking a very specific line and all produced perhaps outside Baltimore.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks.
You bet.
We couldn't possibly come to Kansas City without having some barbecue. The people here love their barbecue, whether it's the upscale kind at Jack Stack or Q39 or the one in a gas station or Arthur Bryant's. That's Senator Claire McCaskill's favorite. We took a trip to the side of a highway in Kansas City, Kansas, to Jones Barbecue, run by Deborah and Mary Jones. Jill Silva knows the scene here better than anyone. She's the food editor for the Kansas City Star.
There's lots of great barbecue out in the world, but of course we're the best, and that's because it all kind of comes together in a melting pot in Kansas City. So we have beef, which is our primary meat, and that comes from our stockyard traditions. However, we do like pulled pork, and we do like...
Burnt ends,
you know, well, that is part of the brisket, of course. Yeah, so... those kind of come together. We also have different woods here, so we're really into hickory and oak with a little bit of fruit wood. Then our sauce is very tomatoey. Got a little note of molasses in there, but we're also open to vinegar and mustard and even Alabama white sauce now and again.
But maybe not as much vinegar as the Carolinians.
Not as much, no. But I mean, we're ecumenical. We'll try a lot of different things, but we know ours is best.
How many restaurants serve barbecue here?
Last I heard, it sounds like we're around 100.
And I have to say, since we've been here, everybody's got their favorite KC barbecue restaurant. We've heard about Gates. We've heard about Jack Stack. We've heard about Joe's.
Joe's KC. Right.
So what's your favorite?
That's like asking somebody to choose their favorite child. It just depends on what you're looking for. I mean, there's great personalities behind the pits. There's also great food. Some are legacy restaurants, some are new, some have full bars and dessert, and others, you know, barely consider the sides. It's all about the meat.
How often does somebody who lives here eat barbecue?
Wow.
Is it a special occasion, or is it like every week you go out and have barbecue?
Nah, well, I guess it depends on the person, but it's not a special occasion. I mean, we get the meat sweats after a while, and we need to eat our meat a certain amount of times. But, you know, I think it varies from person to person.
And when was barbecue introduced here?
Well, the furthest back that I've read is Henry Perry. He was African-American. He worked on the riverboats that came through. So that would have been probably in the mid-1800s, and he decided he would start a barbecue cart, and from there... Kansas City became known for barbecue.
What do you do in Kansas City if you're a vegetarian?
Well, we actually have a new vegan place called the Peaceful, I think it's a cart actually, it's called the Peaceful Pig. There are also some restaurants in town who do charred jackfruit, which is a tropical fruit that you can smoke. So there are some options. I think a lot of the more modern restaurants are actually trying to make sure that if a group of people wants to go out and socialize and they have a vegetarian in their group, that there is definitely something on the menu for everyone.
Now, our listeners can probably hear some of the wind around us right now.
Yeah.
What they can't smell is that we're standing right next to the pit here, and the smoke is probably going to be part of our clothes for the next few days. But
yes,
it smells incredible.
Yes, hickory and oak is what Deborah uses, and her pit's really, really interesting. For your listeners who can't see it, it's actually a secondhand kind of pit that's out in a parking lot. And she's got a little fence around it, and she sits out here in the elements and does her barbecue. And I really give her a lot of credit for coming here day after day, no matter what the weather is, and doing what she loves.
As you can see, we still do a lot of the old, we still do, you know, old school. If you would have came earlier, you would have saw a big fire. Right now, we just want to keep everything, you know, nice and warm.
Deborah Jones loads logs into the pit. She and her sister Mary run this place.
Well, the way I got started was my dad first just taught me and my sister how to barbecue. Told us it was something that maybe might come in handy one day. So we said, okay. And I kind of stayed with it more so than anybody. And that's how I got started.
And how long has this been here?
We've been here about 3 years.
3 years?
Yes, sir.
And where were you before that?
We started at 1805 North 10th Street. That's where we started in 1987.
So what kind of things are you barbecuing?
We barbecue beef, we barbecue pork, we barbecue ribs, we barbecue rib tips, we barbecue chicken, ham. We make our own sausage and we barbecue those.
And are the recipes the same as they were from when your dad was running it?
Yes, sir, from the beginning. Yes, they are. The sauce, the beans, and the sausage are still the same. Mm-hmm.
And what's your secret? Why do people love this barbecue so much?
I think it's because we still do it a little bit on the old school. We still use actual hickory and oak mixed instead of using the, you know, the gas and starting it up that way. We actually just start our fire from the beginning. You know, throw the chips of wood in, the bark off the bark of the tree and crisscross it and stir it up and get our fry started.
How important in creating the flavor that you're going for is the wood that you're using?
I think the wood got a lot to do with the flavor because we don't use no rubs and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
I think that because a lot of people will get the meat and just get the sauce on the side because they just like the smoke flavor. Uh-huh. And the wood, the hickory wood, we cook more hickory than anything. And I think that is what really sets it off.
Tell us about working with your sister all the time. How's that?
Oh, me and my sister, we love each other to death. But we have differences like anybody. But at the end of the day, we still sisters. Anybody tell you that, they'll see us arguing and having a difference. Oh, that's all time. And it don't mean anything.
You argue in the kitchen?
Oh, yeah, all the time. We argue in the pit. Yeah, we all go outside. It don't make no difference. But at the end of the day, we still sisters.
What's the hardest thing to make?
I think the hardest thing to make is the sausage because it's a lot of time consuming with the sausage. Uh-huh. The sausage is time consuming. You got to first cut the meat, then you got to season it, then you got to grind it, then you stuff it through the casings. Yeah, that's the longest procedure. Yeah, the sausage.
Now, you're two women, obviously, two African-American women.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a lot of the owners of barbecue restaurants in this area are men,
mm-hmm.
and even many white men. What does that say to you? Or is there a difference between your backgrounds when it comes to the barbecue you're doing?
Well, it might be a little bit different for his background, but basically, as I'll tell anybody, it was just... Our dad taught us a lot of things besides barbecuing, how to lay carpet, you know, towel, different things, how to fix doors, because he just said, you never know. You may have to do something, get through life. And he just always told us to learn as much as you could. But it's dominated by men or whatever, when we came along, we didn't look at it like that. We were just looking at, you know, our daddy teaching us things in life on what to do.
What is it like now to be a woman in this industry?
You know, being dominating the barbecue field don't bother me one bit. You know, I can fit in with them. You know, I have no problem with it.
Do you think that you bring something that they can't?
Well, of course. I've always bring something. The fact that I'm a woman, that I brought that there, that right there says a lot. And the fact that, you know, I know how to barbecue too. I ain't gonna say I'm the best, but I can stand toe to toe with some of them or any of them. You know, it don't bother me.
Inside the tiny kitchen of Jones Barbecue, there's a book about barbecue, and in the back, a photo of Deborah Jones and her sister Mary, much younger, and dressed to grill. This is you and your sister.
Yes.
What does that mean to you? Because that was not in this place. That's
where it all started. That's where our daddy trained us.
This is where you were trained?
Yes. Uh-huh. On 10th.
What do you think when you see that photo now?
We just laugh. Uh-huh. We laugh.
Why do you laugh?
Because we look back at then and look back now. I mean, and then we write up to now and we say, well, we can come a long way.
Yeah.
We can come a long way.
I couldn't leave without trying the food. A little pulled pork and a little brisket and a side of the famous baked beans. You can't taste it along with me, but you can see photos of Jones Barbecue and that photo we were just talking about at hereandnow.org.
Now, it's not that often we get to speak with anyone inside North Korea, but we're going to do that right now because Will Ripley, CNN's international correspondent, is on his 16th trip to North Korea, his 7th this year, and he joins us from Pyongyang on Skype. Will, welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be with you, Magna.
Well, you spoke with a senior North Korean official just recently. Tell us, who is this man and what did he tell you?
His name is Ri Yong-pil, and he is a senior diplomat at North Korea's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's pretty difficult to have a conversation right now with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, particularly as an American journalist. As you probably know, they've cut off all diplomatic communications with the United States, and they did that after President Trump's speech at the United Nations General Assembly last month when he threatened to totally destroy North Korea and called their supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, Little Rocket Man. At that point, the North Koreans essentially decided that talk with the United States was just not going to get them anywhere. Also, mixed messaging from Secretary of State Tillerson talking about diplomacy, but then President Trump hinting repeatedly about the potential for war. And so the sense that we get from the North Koreans is that they want to prove their capabilities to the United States by demonstrating that they can detonate a nuclear device above ground, the type of device that they could use to threaten the mainland United States.
I mean, this person told you that the United States or the world should take literally their threat to do an above ground test.
It's important to also keep in mind the North Korean mindset about nuclear weapons, which is very different from the way that we view them in the U.S. North Korea feels that nuclear weapons will actually provide peace and stability to the region, which is counterintuitive to what most around the world believe. But they look at other countries like the United States and Russia and China that have significant nuclear arsenals, and they see that these countries are relatively secure, not at risk of being invaded. And so they feel if they also can prove that they have a similar capability, that they will be allowed to exist. Of course, the real danger here, and I've chatted with U.S. government officials just within the last week, is that if they were to go through with such a provocative test that is so dangerous on so many levels, that it could trigger a series of events that could take this region and the world down a road from which there might be no return.
I mean, an above-ground nuclear test is significantly different than the below-ground test that North Korea has performed. I mean, so put this in context for us a little bit. How significant would it be if they actually did this?
The world has not seen an above-ground thermonuclear detonation in nearly four decades since China did it back in 1980. And the reason why countries have stopped doing it is because there are obviously so many risks, environmental risks. What if something went wrong? What if the detonation occurred in an area that was not fully secure and people were in the path of this? So there are just so many reasons why nearly every analysts would advise North Korea, if they could, not to go through with this. But from the North Korean perspective, they look at the fact that the United States and Russia and China and other countries have conducted these tests. It was a natural evolution in their own nuclear programs decades ago, and they feel completely justified in the final stages of their own nuclear development to conduct this kind of test on their own.
Wow. Well, you cite senior officials on both sides in North Korea and the United States who have been telling you, and this isn't necessarily new, but like that diplomacy, it has totally broken down here. We've got a little bit of sound from one of your interviews with a North Korean official.
So then I ask, what needs to happen for diplomacy to resume?
The U.S. needs to understand our new strategic power and fundamentally eliminate its hostile policy towards the DPRK.
So that's the view from North Korea. But Will, what are American diplomats telling you? Is there this understanding, and is there any room for a backing down?
They are deeply troubled, and the diplomats who deal directly with North Korea would like to have a conversation to try to figure out a way to walk back from this. But the difficulty here is that they don't have a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of the North Koreans, again, going back to the mixed messaging from the Trump administration. You have the man at the top talking about a calm before the storm, and then you have his Secretary of State saying, but there's still a diplomatic path. Who are the North Koreans going to find more credible here, especially given the fact that their narrative for decades has been that the United States is just waiting at their doorstep, waiting to invade or drop a nuclear bomb on them?
Well, and now we have President Trump, who leaves for Asia next week, and he's scheduled to be visiting South Korea. Any sense as to how that trip may affect this very delicate moment?
Well, certainly the big question is, will President Trump visit the demilitarized zone along the 38th parallel that separates North and South Korea? The indications based on CNN reporting is that he may avoid that area, which, by the way, would break precedent because every U.S. president since the Korean War has visited the DMZ. It's a place where you can show the U.S. military's commitment to defending the South side of the Korean Peninsula. But the fear with President Trump is that if he were to go to such a sensitive place, literally within eyesight of North Korean soldiers and lots of heavy artillery pointed in either direction, and if he were to go there and make an inflammatory statement, that could really drive the situation to an even worse place than it is right now, if you can even imagine that happening.
Well, Will Ripley is CNN's international correspondent, speaking with us from Pyongyang, North Korea. Will, thank you so very much.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at KCUR in Kansas City today. This is Here and Now.